hard enough not to get shaken loose, hard enough to get the guy's attention, which it did right away, because the guy went immediately quiet and still. With his left hand, Reacher picked up his phone, and then took his gun, which was another H&K P7, just like the two he had already. Maybe standard issue west of center, maybe a bulk order, at a good price, from some bent German copper. With his left hand, he put the phone and the gun in his pockets. With his right hand, he pressed his own H&K harder on the guy's eyeball. "Let's take a walk," he said. The guy got up off his stool, awkward, all bent backward against the pressure, and he shuffled around and backed out the door to the sidewalk, where Reacher turned him right and pushed him 6 more backward paces and turned him right again, backward into an alley that smelled like a garbage receptacle and a kitchen door. Reacher backed the guy against the wall. He said, "How many people saw?" The guy said, "Saw what?" "You with a gun to your head." "A few, I guess." "How many came to help you out?" The guy didn't answer. "Yeah, none of them," Reacher said. "No one likes you. No one would piss on you if you were on fire. So it's just you and me now. No one is going to ride to the rescue. Are we clear on that?"
"What do you want?"
"Where is Max Trulenko?"
"No one knows."
"Someone must."
"Not me," the guy said. "I promise. I swear on my sister's life."
"Where is your sister right now?"
"Kiev."
"Which makes your promise kind of theoretical, don't you think? Try again."
"On my life," the guy said.
"Which is not so theoretical," Reacher said. He pressed harder with the H&K. Through the steel, he felt the guy's eyeball squash. He felt the jelly. The guy gasped and said,
"I swear I don't know where Trulenko is."
"But you heard of him?"
"Of course."
"Does he work for Gregory now?"
"That's what I heard."
"Where?"
"No one knows," the guy said. "It's a big secret."
"You sure?"
"On my mother's grave."
"Which is where?"
"You got to believe me. Maybe 6 people know where Trulenko is. I ain't one of them. Please, sir, I'm just a doorman."
Reacher took the gun away. He stepped back. The guy blinked and rubbed his eye and stared through the gloom. Reacher kicked him hard in the nuts and left him there, doubled over, making all kinds of retching and puking sounds. Reacher got back to Center Street with no trouble anywhere. His problems started immediately after that, when he was east of Center, which he didn't understand at all. Wrong faction, surely. But right away he felt eyes on him. He felt people watching him. No benevolence in their gaze. He knew that absolutely. He got a chill on his neck. Some kind of an ancient instinct. A sixth sense. A survival mechanism baked deep in the back of his brain by evolution. How not to get eaten. Millions of years of practice. His 100,000 times great-great-grandmother stiffening, changing course, looking for the trees and the shadows, living to fight another day, living to have a kid who 100,000 generations later had a descendant also looking for the shadows, not on the verdant savanna, but on the gray nighttime streets as he slid by lit-up clubs and bars and storefront restaurants. It was the men in suits who were watching him, organized guys, made men, and the soon-to-be. Why? He didn't know. Had he upset the Albanians, too? He didn't see how. Mostly he had done them a favor, surely, according to their own crude calculus. They should be giving him a parade. He moved on. He heard a footstep far behind him. He kept on walking. The glow of Center Street was long gone, both literally and figuratively. The streets ahead were narrow and dark, and got shabbier with every step. There were parked cars and alleys and deep doorways. 2 out of 3 streetlights were busted. There were no pedestrians. His kind of place. He stopped walking. More than one way not to get eaten. Grandma's instinct worked for today. 100,000 generations later, her descendant's instinct worked for tomorrow, too. And forever. More efficient. Natural selection right there. He stood in the half-gloom for a minute, and then backed away into deep shadow, and listened. He heard the diamond scrape of a leather sole on the sidewalk, maybe 40 feet back. Some kind of hastily arranged surveillance. Some guy suddenly ordered off his stool and out into the night, to follow. But for how long? That was the critical question. All the way home? Or only as far as a hastily arranged up-ahead ambush? Reacher waited. He heard the leather sole again, or its opposite number on the other foot, taking a cautious step, moving forward. He pressed deeper into the shadows, into a doorway. He leaned up against ribs of carved stone, a fancy entrance, some long-forgotten enterprise, no doubt rewarding while it lasted. He heard the scrape of the shoe again, now maybe 20 feet back, making progress. He heard nothing from the other direction, just city quiet and old air and the faint smell of soot and bricks. He heard the shoe again, now 10 feet back, still making progress. He waited. The guy was already within range, but another couple of steps would make the whole thing more comfortable. He sketched out the geometry in his head. He put his hand in his pocket and found the H&K he had used before, because he knew for sure it worked. Always an advantage. Another step. The guy was maybe 7 feet away. Not small. The sound of his shoe was a faint, heavy, grinding, spreading crunch. The sound of a big guy, creeping slow. Now 4 feet away. Showtime. Reacher stepped out and turned to face the guy. The H&K gleamed in the dark. He aimed it at the guy's face. The guy went cross-eyed, trying to stare at it in the poor illumination. Reacher said, "Don't make a sound." The guy didn't. Reacher listened beyond his shoulder. Did the guy have backup behind him? Apparently not. Nothing to hear. Same as up ahead. City quiet and old air. Reacher said, "Do we have a problem?" The guy was 6 feet and maybe 220, maybe 40 years old, lean and hard, all bone and muscle and dark, suspicious eyes. His lips were clamped tight and pulled back in a rictus grin that could have been worried, or quizzical, or contemptuous. "Do we have a problem?" Reacher asked again. "You're a dead man," the guy said. "Not so far," Reacher said. "In fact, right now you're closer to that unhappy state than I am. Don't you think? Mess with me, and you're messing with a lot of people." "Am I messing with you? Or are you messing with me?"
"We want to know who you are."
"Why? What did I do to you?"
"Above my pay grade," the guy said. "All I got to do is bring you in."
"Well, good luck with that," Reacher said.
"Easy to say with a gun in my face."
Reacher shook his head in the gloom. "Easy to say anytime," he said. He stepped back a pace and put the gun back in his pocket. He stood there, empty-handed, palms out, with his arms held away from his sides.
"There you go," he said.
"Now you can bring me in." The guy didn't move. He was 5 inches down in height, maybe 30 pounds in weight, maybe a whole foot in reach. Evidently unarmed, because otherwise his weapon would have been out and in his hand already. Evidently unsettled, too, by Reacher's gaze, which was steady and calm and slightly amused, but also undeniably predatory, and even a little unhinged. Not a good situation for the guy to be in. Reacher said, "Maybe we could get to the same place a different way." The guy said,
"How?"
"Give me your phone. Tell your boss to call me. I'll tell him who I am. The personal touch is always better."
"I can't give you my phone."
"I'm going to take it anyway. Your choice when." The gaze, steady, calm, amused, predatory, unhinged. The guy said,
"Okay."
Reacher said, "Take it out and set it down on the sidewalk." The guy did. "Now turn around." The guy did. "Now run away as far and as fast as you can." The guy did. He took off at a muscle-bound sprint and was immediately swallowed up by the urban darkness. His footsteps rang out long after he had disappeared from sight. This time, he made no attempt at stealth. Reacher listened to the rapid slapping and crunching and sliding until the sound quieted down and faded away to nothing. Then he picked up the phone and walked on. 3 blocks from Barton's house, Reacher took off his jacket and folded it into a square, and rolled the square into a tube, and stuffed the tube inside a rusted mailbox outside a one-story office building with boarded-up windows and fire damage on the siding. He walked the rest of the way in his t-shirt only. The nighttime air was cool. It was still springtime. The full weight of summer was yet to come. Hogan was waiting for him in Barton's hallway. The drummer, once a U.S. Marine, now enjoying patterns he alone controlled. "You okay?" he asked. "Were you worried about me?" Reacher said, professionally curious. "I wasn't playing a gig with the Rolling Stones. My previous profession."
"Objective achieved," Reacher said.
"Which was what exactly?"
"I wanted a Ukrainian phone. Apparently they text each other a lot. I figured I could look back and see where they're up to with this. Maybe they mentioned Trulenko. Maybe I could make them panic and make them move him. That would be the time of maximum opportunity."
Abby came down the stairs, still dressed. She said, "Hey." Reacher said, "Hey," back.
"I heard all that. Good plan. Except won't they just kill the phone remotely? You won't hear from them and they won't hear from you."
"I chose the guy I took it from pretty carefully. He was relatively competent, therefore relatively trusted, maybe relatively senior, therefore relatively reluctant to fess up that I took his lunch money. I left him a little embarrassed. He won't report anything in a hurry. It's a pride thing. I think I have a few hours at least."
"Okay, good plan, except nothing."
"Except I'm not great with phones. There might be menus. All kinds of buttons to press. I might delete something by mistake."
"Okay, show me."
"And even if I don't delete them by mistake, the texts are probably in Ukrainian, which I can't read without the internet. And I'm really not great with computers."
"That would be the second step. We would need to start with the phone. Show me."
"I didn't bring it here," Reacher said. "The guy in the Lincoln claimed they could be traced. I don't want someone knocking on the door 5 minutes from now."
"So where is it?"
"I hid it 3 blocks from here. I figured that was safe enough. Pi times the radius squared. They would have to search nearly a 30-block circle. They wouldn't even try."
Abby said, "Okay, let's go take a look."
"I also got an Albanian phone. Kind of accidentally. But in the end, the same kind of deal. I want to read it. Maybe I can figure out what they're mad with me about."
"Are they mad with you?"
"They sent a guy after me. They want to know who I am."
"That could be normal. You're a new face in town. They like to know things."
"Maybe." Hogan said, "There's a guy you should talk to."
Reacher said, "What guy?"
"He comes to gigs sometimes. A dog face, just like you."
"Army?"
"Stands for, aren't really Marines yet."
"Like Marine stands for muscles are requested, intelligence not expected.
This guy I'm talking about speaks a bunch of old commie languages. He was a company commander late on in the Cold War. Also, he knows what's going on here in town. He could be helpful, or at least useful, with the languages especially. You can't rely on a computer translation, not for a thing like this. I could call him, if you like."
"You know him well?"
"He's solid. Good taste in music."
"Do you trust him?"
"As much as I trust any dog face who doesn't play the drums."
"Okay," Reacher said. "Call him. Can't hurt."
He and Abby stepped out to the nighttime stillness, and Hogan stayed behind in the half-lit hallway, dialing his phone.
Chapter 25
Reacher and Abby covered the 3-block distance via a roundabout route. Obviously, if the phones were truly traceable, they might have already been discovered in what was clearly a temporary stash,
in which case surveillance might have been set up against their eventual retrieval. Better to play it safe, or as safe as possible, which wasn't very. There were shadows and alleys and deep doorways, and 2 out of every 3 streetlights were busted. There was plenty of habitat for hidden nighttime watchers. Reacher saw the rusty mailbox up ahead, the middle of the next block. He said, "Pretend we're having some kind of a deep conversation, and when we get level with the mailbox, we stop to make an especially big point." "Okay," Abby said. "Then what?" "Then we ignore the mailbox completely and we move on. But at that point, very quietly, we glide away." "An actual pretend conversation? Or just moving our lips, like a silent movie?" "Maybe whispered, like we're dealing with secret information."
"Starting when?"
"Now," Reacher said. "Keep on walking. Don't slow down."
"What do you want to whisper about?"
"I guess whatever is on your mind."
"Are you serious? We could be walking into a dangerous situation here. That's what's on my mind."
"You said you want to do one thing every day that scares you."
"I'm already way over quota."
"And you survived every time."
"We could be walking into a hail of gunfire."
"They won't shoot me. They want to ask me questions."
"You absolutely sure?"
"It's a psychological dynamic, like in the theater. It's not necessarily the kind of thing that has a yes or no answer." The mailbox was coming up.
"Get ready to stop," Reacher whispered. "And give them a stationary target?"
"Only as long as it takes to make a big imaginary statement. Then we move on again, but very quietly, okay?" Reacher stopped. Abby stopped. She said,
"What kind of big imaginary statement?"
"Whatever is on your mind." She was quiet a beat. Then she said,
"No. What's on my mind is I don't want to make a statement about what's on my mind. Not yet. That's my statement."
"Go," he said. They moved on, as quiet as they could. 3 paces. 4. "Okay," Reacher said. Abby said,
"Okay, what?"
"No one here."
"And we know this how?"
"You tell me." She was quiet another beat, and then she said,
"We were quiet because we were listening."
"And what did we hear?"
"Nothing."
"Exactly. We paused right by the target, and we heard no one stepping out or tensing up, and then we moved on, and we heard no one stepping back and relaxing, or scuffling around, waiting for word on Plan B. Therefore, there's no one here."
"That's great."
"So far," Reacher said. "But who knows how long these things take? Not my area of expertise. They could be here any minute."
"So what should we do?"
"I guess we should take the phones someplace else. We should make them start the search all over again." 2 blocks south, they saw headlight beams coming out of a cross street, like a distant early warning. Seconds later, a car made the left and drove up toward them, slowly, maybe searching. Or maybe just a regular nighttime driver worried about a ticket or a DUI. Hard to tell. The headlights were low and wide-spaced. A big sedan. It kept on coming. "Stand by," Reacher said.
"Nothing."
The car drove past. Same steady speed. Same decided direction. An old Cadillac. The driver looked neither left nor right. An old lady, peering out from underneath the rim of the steering wheel. Abby said,
"Whatever, we better be quick about this. Because like you said, we don't know how long these things take."
They walked back, 4 fast paces, and Reacher pulled his rolled-up jacket out of the rusty mailbox. Abby carried the phones. She insisted. They walked another 3 blocks on another roundabout route and found a bodega open late. No man in a suit on the door. No suits anywhere, as a matter of fact. The clerk at the register was wearing a white T-shirt. There were no other customers. The space was crowded with humming chiller cabinets and bright with fluorescent light. There was a 2-top table in back, unoccupied. Reacher got 2 cardboard cups of coffee and carried them back to the table. Abby had the phones laid out side by side. She was looking at them, conflicted, as if half eager to get started on them and half worried about them. As if they were pulsing secret SOS signals out into the ether. "Find me. Find me." Which they were. She said, "Can you remember which was which?" "No," he said. "They all look the same to me." She clicked one to life. No password required. For speed. And arrogance. And easy internal review. She dabbed and swiped through a bunch of screens. Reacher saw a vertical array of green message bubbles. Texts. Unreadable foreign words, but mostly regular letters, the same as English. Some were doubled up. Some had strange accents above or below. Umlauts and cedillas. Albanian, Reacher said. Out on the street, a car drove by. Slowly. Its headlight wash scoured a thin blue blade of light across the room. All the way along the back wall, and then all the way along the end wall, and then it was gone. Abby clicked the second phone to life. No password. She found another long sequence of text messages, to and from. Green bubbles, one after the other. All in the Cyrillic alphabet. Named for Saint Cyril, who worked on alphabets in the 9th century. Ukrainian, Reacher said. "There are hundreds of texts here," Abby said. "Literally hundreds, maybe thousands." Another car drove by outside, faster. Reacher said, "Can you make out the dates?" Abby scrolled and said, "There are at least 50 since yesterday. Your picture is in some of them." Another car drove by outside, this time slowly, lights on bright, searching for something or worried about a ticket. A glimpse of the driver, a man in dark clothing, his face lit up spooky by the lights on his dash. "There are at least 50 Albanian texts, too," Abby said. "Maybe more." "So how do we do this?" Reacher asked. "We can't take the phones home. We can't copy out all this crap onto napkins. We would make mistakes, and it would take forever. We don't have time." "Watch me," Abby said. She took out her own phone. She squared the Ukrainian phone on the tabletop. She hovered her own phone above it, parallel, moving in, moving out, until satisfied. "Taking a picture?" Reacher asked. "Video," she said. "Watch." She held her own phone in her left hand, and with her right forefinger, she scrolled through a long and complex chain of Ukrainian texts on the captured phone at a moderate speed, on and on, consistent, 5 seconds, 10, 15, 20. Then the end of the chain bounced to a halt, and she shut off the recording. She said, "We can play it and pause it as much as we want. We can freeze it anywhere. Just as good as having the phones themselves." She did the same thing with the Albanian phone. 5 seconds, 10, 15, 20. "Nice work," Reacher said. "Now we should move these phones again. Can't leave them here. This place doesn't deserve a visit from the goon squad." "So where?" "I vote back in the mailbox." "But that's ground zero for their search. If they're behind the curve a little, they could be getting there right about now. Actually, I'm hoping being in a small metal box will cut off the transmissions. They won't be able to search at all."
"Then they never could."
"Probably not."
"Then there never was any danger."
"Until we took them out."
"How long does it take for a thing like that?"
"We already agreed. Neither one of us knows."
"Does it have to be that mailbox? How about the nearest mailbox?"
"No collateral damage," Reacher said. "Just in case."
"You don't really know, do you?"
"It's not necessarily the kind of thing that has a yes or no answer."
"Are the transmissions cut off or not?"
"I'm guessing probably. Not my area of expertise. But I listen to people talk. They're forever bitching and moaning about their calls cutting out, for all kinds of reasons, all of which sound much less serious than getting shut in a small metal box."
"But right now they're right here on the table, so there is currently a degree of danger."
Reacher nodded. "Getting larger every minute," he said. This time Reacher carried the phones, for no reason other than normal squad rotation. There were plenty of cars around, plenty of bouncing, blinding headlight beams, all kinds of makes and models, but no Lincoln Town cars, no sudden changes in speed or direction. Apparently, no interest at all. They put the phones in the mailbox and squealed it shut. This time, Reacher kept his jacket. Not just for the warmth. for the guns in the pockets. They set out to walk back to Barton's house. They got less than a block and a half. Chapter 26. Nothing to do with complex triangulations of cell phone signals or GPS pinpoint telltales accurate to half a yard. Much later, Reacher figured it had happened the old school way. A random guy in a random car had remembered his pre-watch briefing. That was all. Be on the lookout. A man and a woman. Reacher and Abby made a right, intending to make the next left, which involved walking the length of a cobblestone block on a narrow sidewalk, defined on the right-hand side by an unbroken sequence of iron-bound loading docks in back of the next street's buildings, and on the left-hand side by a sporadic line of cars parked on the curb. Not every space was filled, maybe 50-50. One of the cars was parked the wrong way around, head-on. It had no nighttime dew on it. In the split second it took the back of Reacher's brain to spark the front, the car's door opened and the driver's gun came out, followed by the driver's hand and then the driver himself, in a smooth, athletic crouch, concealed behind the open door, aiming level through the open window. At Reacher, at first, then at Abby, then back again, and again, back and forth, like on a TV show. The guy was making it clear he was covering both of them at once. He was wearing a blue suit and a red tie tied tight. They won't shoot me. They want to ask me questions. It's a psychological dynamic, like in the theater. It's not necessarily the kind of thing that has a yes or no answer. The gun was a Glock 17, a little scratched and worn. The guy was using a two-handed grip. Both wrists were resting on the window rubber. His trigger finger was in position. The gun was steady. Its left-right arc was controlled and horizontal only. Competent, except that a crouch was an inherently unstable position, and also a pointless one, because a car door offered no kind of meaningful protection against a bullet. Better than aluminum foil, but not much. A smart guy would stand straight and rest his wrists on top of the door. More commanding. Easier to transition to whatever came next, like walking, or running, or fighting. The guy with the gun called out, "Keep your hands where I can see them." Reacher called back, "Do we have a problem?" The guy called out, "I don't have a problem." "Okay," Reacher said. "Good to know." He turned to Abby and said, quieter, "You could head back to the corner if you like. I could join you there in a minute. This guy wants to ask me questions, is all." But the guy called out, "No, she stays too, both of you." A man and a woman. Reacher turned to face front again and used the maneuver to conceal half a step of forward progress. He said, "We stay for what?"
"Questions."
"Ask away."
"My boss will ask the questions."
"Where is he?"
"Coming."
"What's on his mind?"
"Many things, I'm sure."
"Okay," Reacher said. "Put the gun away and come out from there and we'll all wait together. Right here on the sidewalk. Until he shows up." The guy stayed crouched behind his door. The gun didn't move.
"You can't use it anyway," Reacher said.
"Your boss wouldn't like it if he showed up and found us dead or wounded or in shock or in a coma or quivering with some kind of traumatic stress disorder. He wants to ask us questions. He wants coherent answers that make sense. Plus, the cops wouldn't stand for it. I don't care what kind of accommodations you think you got with them. A gunshot on a city street at night is going to get a reaction."
"You think you're a smart guy?"
"No, but I'm hoping you are." The gun didn't move, which was okay. The trigger was the important part, specifically the finger, which was connected to the guy's central nervous system, which could get all frozen up, even if just temporarily, with doubts and thoughts and second guesses. Or at least slowed down a beat. Reacher took another step. He raised his left hand halfway, palm out, patting the air, a conciliatory gesture, but also urgent, as if there was an immediate problem to solve. The guy's gaze followed the moving object and appeared to miss Reacher's right hand, which was also moving, but slower and lower. It slipped unobtrusively into his right-hand pocket, where the H&K was that he knew for sure worked. The guy said, "We wait in the car, not on the sidewalk." "Okay," Reacher said. "Doors closed." "Sure. You in the back, me in the front." "Until your boss shows up," Reacher said. "Then he can get in the front with you. He can ask his questions. Is that the plan?" "Until then, you keep quiet." "Sure," Reacher said again. "You win. You're the man with the gun, after all. We'll get in the car." The guy nodded, satisfied. After which, it was easy. The guy dropped the outer fingers out of his two-handed grip and pressed them hard on the window rubber, tented, like a pianist playing an emphatic chord, which could have been a semaphore signal that a conclusive agreement had been reached, but was more likely simple physics, as the guy prepared to boost and balance and bounce his way up out of his crouch, which by then had been going on a long time, to bad effect in terms of numbness and tingle. Either way, the gun came under reduced control, and its butt tipped back and its barrel tipped up, which again could have been seen as a gesture, that the immediate threat was thereby formally withdrawn in favor of newfound cooperation, but was more likely weight and balance and a natural backward rotation around the trigger guard. Reacher left the H&K in his pocket. He took a long pace forward and kicked the car door gently. It clanged back and whacked the guy in the knees, and that small pulse of force rolled him backward over the balls of his feet, agonizingly slow, but irresistible, until finally he rolled over on his back, helpless, like a turtle. His hands whipped up to break his fall, and the clenched Glock hit the sidewalk with a plastic smack and bounced loose and skittered away. But then the guy jerked sideways and rolled once and sprang up, from the horizontal to the vertical, almost instantly and without apparent effort. Athletic, like he had been minutes before getting out of the car. All of which meant Reacher got there half a step late. The guy danced sideways, out of range of the swing of the still-open driver's door, and then he came up with another instant change of direction, suddenly leaning in and launching a clubbing right at Reacher's face, which Reacher saw coming, so he ducked and twisted and took it high on the shoulder, all sharp knuckles. Not much of a blow, but even so, the action and reaction opened up a fractional gap between them, just a split second, which, given the guy's speed, meant he could dance away again, scuffing his feet across the ground, glancing down, searching for his gun. Physically, Reacher could have been called athletic in his own right, but it was a heavyweight kind of athleticism, a kind of weightlifter savagery, not nimbleness. He was fast, but not real fast. He was not capable of an instant reversal of momentum, which meant he spent a certain half-second of time locked in a neutral position, neither stop nor go, during which interval the other guy threw another punch, which Reacher ducked and dodged again, and like before, the guy danced away to safety and searched on another radius, scuffing his feet, glancing down in the dark. Reacher kept on coming, a half-step at a time, dodging and weaving, on the one hand slow in comparison, but on the other hand hard to stop, especially with the kind of weak blows so far attempted. And furthermore, the guy was tiring all the time, hopping about and breathing hard. The guy danced away. Reacher kept on coming. The guy found his gun. The side of the guy's shoe tapped against it and sent it skittering an extra inch with a brief plastic scraping sound, unmistakable. The guy froze for an imperceptible period, just a blink of time, thinking as fast as he was about to act, and then he swooped down, twisting, his right hand whipping through a long arc, aiming to snatch up the gun and grab it tight and whirl it away to safety. An instinctive calculation, based on space and time and speed, all four dimensions, with his own generous capabilities no doubt accurately accounted for, and his opponent's capabilities no doubt cautiously estimated, based on worst-case averages, plus a safety margin, for the purposes of the arithmetic, which still showed plenty of time for a guy as quick as he was. Reacher's own instinctive calculation came to the same conclusion. He agreed. No way he could get there first. except that some of his disadvantages carried their own compensation. His limbs were slow because they were heavy, and they were heavy because they were not only thick but also long. In the case of his legs, very long. He drove hard off his left foot and kicked out with his right, stretching low, a huge, vicious wingspan, aiming at anything, any part of the guy, any part of the swoop, any window of time, whatever came along. What came along was the guy's head. A freak result. Four-dimensional geometry gone wrong. His slight hesitation, Reacher's primeval thrust, triggered by instinct, soaked in ancient all-or-nothing aggression. The guy chose to keep his head up and his arm long, all the better to scoop up the gun and wheel away. But Reacher was already there, like a batter early on a fastball, a foul ball for sure, and the guy hit the first inch of his follow-through, his temple solidly against the welt of Reacher's shoe. Not a perfect connection, but close to it. The guy's neck snapped back, and he scraped and clattered cheek down on the sidewalk. Reacher watched him. He said, "Do you see his gun somewhere?" The guy wasn't moving. Abby said, "I see it. Pick it up. Finger and thumb, butt or barrel." "I know how. Just checking. Always safer that way." She darted in, knelt, picked up the Glock, and darted back. The guy still wasn't moving. She said, "What should we do about him?" Reacher said, "We should leave him right where he is." "And then what?" "We should steal his car."
"Why?"
"His boss is coming. We need to leave the right kind of message."
"You can't declare war on them."
"They already did. On me. For no apparent reason. So now I'm offering a robust initial response. I'm saying their policy should be reconsidered. It's a standard diplomatic move. Like playing chess. It gives them a chance to parley. No harm, no foul. I hope they see that." Abby said, "This is the Albanian mob we're talking about. You're one guy. Frank is right. This is crazy." "But it's happening," Reacher said. "We can't roll the clock back. We can't wish it away. We just have to deal with it the best we can. So we can't leave the car here. Too meek and mild. Like we're saying, oops, sorry. Like we didn't really mean it. We got to make a point. We got to say, don't mess with us or you get a kick in the head and your car stolen. That way they'll take it seriously. They'll act with an element of tactical caution. They'll assemble larger forces."
"That's a bad thing."
"Only if they find us. Assuming they don't, all they're doing by bunching up is leaving bigger gaps elsewhere for us to walk through."
"Walk through where?"
"I guess the ultimate goal would be a face-to-face meeting with the big boss, Gregory's equivalent."
"Dino," Abby said, "that's crazy."
"He's one guy, same as me. We could have an exchange of views. I'm sure it's just a misunderstanding."
"I have to work in this town. One side of center or the other."
"I apologize," Reacher said.
"You should.
But that's why we need to do this right. We need to play to win."
"Okay. We'll steal the car."
"Or we could set it on fire."
"Stealing is better," she said. "I want to get out of here as fast as I can."
They drove the car four blocks into a tangle of blank urban streets, and they left it on a corner, keys in, all four doors standing open, plus the hood, plus the trunk. Somehow symbolic. Then they walked back to Barton's place, via a long circuitous route, and they checked all four sides of his block before they stepped to his door. He was up, waiting, with Hogan. Plus a third guy, who Reacher had never seen before. Chapter 27. The third guy in Barton's hallway had the kind of hair and skin that made a person look 10 years younger than he really was, which therefore in reality made him about Reacher's own generation. He was smaller and neater. He had sharp, watchful eyes, set deep either side of a blade of a nose. He had a long, unruly lock of hair that fell across his forehead. He was dressed with a modicum of style, in good shoes and corduroy pants and a shirt and a jacket. Joe Hogan said, "This is who I was telling you about. The dog face who knows all the old commie languages. His name is Guy Van Tresca." Reacher stuck out his hand. "Pleased to meet you," he said. "Likewise," Van Tresca said, and he shook hands, and then he did so all over again with Abby. Reacher said, "You got here fast." "I was still awake," Van Tresca said. "I live close by." "Thanks for helping out." "Actually, that's not why I'm here. I came to warn you off. You can't mess with these people. Too many, too nasty, too protected. That would be my assessment."
"Were you military intelligence?"
Van Tresca shook his head. "Armor," he said. A company commander laid on in the Cold War, Hogan had called him.
"Tanks?" Reacher asked.
14 of them, Van Tresca said. "All mine, all facing east. Happy days."
"Why did you learn the languages?"
"I thought we were going to win. I thought I might be ruling a civilian district, or at least ordering a bottle of wine in a restaurant, or meeting girls. It was a long time ago. Plus, Uncle Sam paid for it. Back then, the Army liked education. Everyone was getting postgraduate degrees."
Reacher said, "Too many and too nasty are subjective judgments. We can talk about that kind of stuff later. But too protected is different. What do you know about that?"
"I do some corporate consulting, mostly physical security of buildings. But I hear things, and I get asked things. Last year, a federal project ran a set of integrated numbers from all across the nation, and it turned out the two most law-abiding populations in America were the Ukrainian and Albanian communities right here in town. They don't even get parking tickets."
"That suggests a very close relationship with all levels of law enforcement." "But there must be a red line somewhere. I suggested to one of them that gunfire on the city streets at night would get a reaction, and the guy didn't argue. In fact, I guess he agreed with me, because he didn't pull the trigger.
Plus, we're getting a new police commissioner. They're nervous. But there's still plenty of boring, invisible stuff their side of the line. Generally speaking, this type of thing isn't about bullets in the street. It's about someone having a cozy chat with a potential witness, out of sight, out of earshot, probably in the witness's own home, probably in a meaningful location, like an infant daughter's bedroom, about what a weird thing memory is, how it comes and goes, how it fades in and out, how it plays tricks, and about how it's no shame at all to say, 'Look, man, I just can't recall.' People I know say that kind of case is very hard to investigate and very easy to bury."
"How many of them are there?"
"Too many. Like I said, too many, too nasty, too protected. You should forget it."
"Where was your company in the order of battle?"
"Pretty near the tip of the spear," Van Tresca said.
"In other words, hopelessly outnumbered, from day one and possibly forever."
"I get the point you're trying to make. But I had 14 Abrams tanks. They were the finest fighting vehicles in the world. They were like something out of a science fiction book. I wasn't walking through the Fulda Gap in a pair of pants and a jacket."
"As always with armored people, you over-fetishize the machine. That said, clearly you felt you were more lethal than them. Outnumbered, but nastier. But in turn, they were certainly protected by a whole giant nation. One out of three in your favor, two out of three against. But even so, you would have started your engines if they had told you to."
"I get the point," Van Tresca said again.
"And you expected to win," Reacher said, "which is why you learned the languages, which are all I really need right now. I'm taking this one step at a time. First, I need to understand what they're saying in the texts, and then I need to use what I learn in order to figure out what to do next. No combat readiness yet. No warnings necessary."
"Suppose what you learn is that it's hopeless."
"Not an acceptable outcome. Can only be a failure of planning. Surely they taught you that in Germany."
"Okay," Van Tresca said. "One step at a time."
They worked in the kitchen and started with the Ukrainian language. Van Tresca admired Abby's video capture.
Smart, to the point, and efficient. He tapped his finger on the screen in a slow, syncopated rhythm. Play, pause, play, pause. And he read aloud from the freeze-framed screen, at first slow and halting, and then sometimes stopping altogether. Because linguistically, he was in trouble from the start. These were text messages, full of unknown slang and single-letter abbreviations and in-group acronyms, and also full of what could only be misspellings, unless, in fact, they were deliberate simplifications, perhaps following a convention developed especially for the medium. No one knew. Ventresca said the task could take him some time. He said it would be like translating a difficult foreign language while simultaneously breaking an espionage code. Or maybe two codes, given the oblique allusions and elisions any self-respecting gangster would be expected to use. Abby got her laptop and worked with him side by side, tackling individual words with online dictionaries, or searching the single-letter abbreviations or the acronyms on language blogs and word nerd sites. She made notes on scraps of paper. A couple of things fell into place, but even so, the work was slow. Never had so much come from so little. She had made the video as fast as she dared. 5, 10, 20 seconds, scrolling at speed, pumping on and on. Now that vivid blur was giving up thousands and thousands of words, each one a challenge and a puzzle, most of them with two or three plausible solutions. Reacher let them work. He hung out in the front parlor with Barton and Hogan, in the spaces between the drums and the speaker cabinets. One cabinet was gray and about the size of a refrigerator. It had 8 dirty circles on its grill. Reacher sat on the floor and leaned his back against it, and it didn't move at all. Barton hauled his battered Fender up into his lap and played it unplugged, barely audible, with up and down runs of soft, buzzy notes. Hogan said, "Do you think we would have won? Do you think Ventresca would have wound up using his languages?" "On balance, I think we would have prevailed," Reacher said. "As a technical matter, I think we would have shut them down before they shut us down. Hard to call it winning, given the mess it would have made. But whatever, the tip of the spear would have been vaporized long ago. I'm afraid your friend wasted his time in school." Barton played a descending arpeggio, some kind of diminished minor chord, and ended with a bang on the open bottom string. Plugged in, it would have demolished the house. Unplugged, the string rattled and clattered against the frets, and gave out no fundamental at all. Barton looked at Reacher and said, "Now you're the tip of the spear." "I'm not looking to start a war," Reacher said. "All I want is the Shevik's money. If I can get it some kind of easy way, I absolutely will, believe me. I don't feel the need to meet any of them face to face on the field of battle. In fact, I would be happier not to."
"You won't get the option. They must have Trulenko buttoned up pretty tight. Layers and layers. I've seen them do it when a name comes to one of their clubs. They have a man on the corner, and a man on the door, and a man on the next door along, plus a couple of extra guys just roaming around."
"What do you remember about Trulenko?"
"He was a nerd, like all those guys. I remember thinking it shouldn't turn out that way. I was cool in high school. Now the nerds are billionaires and I'm scraping a living. I guess I should have learned software, not music."
"If he was working, what would he be doing?"
"Is he working?"
Someone used that word.
"Then computers, I'm sure. That's what he was good at. He was one of the top boys. His app was something to do with doctors, but basically all that stuff is computer software, isn't it?"
Abby stuck her head in the door.
"We figured it out," she said. "We're ready to go with the Ukrainian. They mentioned Trulenko twice."
Chapter 28. Ventresca reset the video so it would play from the beginning. But before he ran it, he said, "Overall, there's some weird shit going down. Apart from anything else, they're in an uproar because they're losing people. Two guys got in a wreck up at the Ford dealer. Then two bagmen got taken off a block in the gourmet quarter. Then two more guys got taken out of a massage parlor. Then two more guys went missing outside of Abby's house. Total of 8 so far. It's carnage out there, Reacher said. What's interesting is they blamed the Albanians for the first 6, but the language changed for the last 2. Now they're blaming you. They think you're on some secret New York or Chicago payroll, covertly employed to stir things up down here. There's an all-points bulletin out on you, under the name of Shevik, which in the end could prove to be a bigger problem. Van Tresca clicked Abby's phone and started the video. At first, he let it spool at the same speed she had recorded it. On the screen, the shadow of her fingertip was visible on the right side of the image, scooting up, up, up. Then Van Tresca paused and restarted and paused again until he found the bubble he wanted. It contained a photograph above the text. Aaron and Maria Shevik and Abigail Gibson in the hallway of the Shevik's home, looking startled and a little uneasy. Reacher remembered the sound he heard from behind the kitchen door. The quiet, scratchy click. The cell phone, imitating a camera. Van Tresca said, "The text below the image says the people in the picture are Jack, Joanna, and Abigail Reacher." He played and paused, through 4 more bubbles. He stopped on a 5th. He said, "Right here they've already figured out it's Abby Gibson, not Abigail Reacher. Next message down, they're sending a guy to her place of work to get her home address." He moved the video on. "And here they have her home address, and now they're sending a car to her house, with orders to bring her in if they find her." "All's well that ends well," Reacher said. "It gets worse," Van Tresca said. He moved the video on again, to a fat green bubble from later in the day, which had the same photograph in it again, above a dense block of Cyrillic writing. Van Tresca read out loud, "It has been reported that the old woman named Joanna Reacher in the picture above was in our pawn shop where she signed her name Maria Shevik." "Shit," Reacher said. "That was their shop?" "She should have expected it. Most everything is theirs on the west side. Problem is, she gave them her real name, which makes it at least somewhat likely she gave them her real address and her real social security number too, which puts them one step away from finding out she's Aaron Shevik's legal wife. From that point on, it's not going to be rocket science to figure out who's really who. Whereupon they can act as fast as they like. They're already waiting outside the house. They'll be plunged into an existential crisis. Do they want Aaron Shevik the name, or Aaron Shevik the physical human being who borrowed their money and is apparently covertly stirring them up? What, after all, is the nature of identity? It's a question they'll have to wrestle with." "Are you a West Pointer?" "How could you tell?" "The level of bullshit. This could get very serious. Obviously, they want the right physical human being, but however they set about getting him, you gotta figure a little china will get broken along the way. Starting right inside that house." Reacher nodded. "I know," he said. "Believe me. It's already very serious. They're 70 years old. But I don't see what I can do about their physical safety. Not around the clock. The only rational response would be evacuate them to a safe location. But where? I don't have the resources." He paused a beat. Then he said, "Normally, with this kind of thing, I would say, go stay with your daughter. I'm sure they would love to." Van Tresca moved the video to a fat bubble from late the night before. He said, "This is where you say the name Trulenko to the doorman where Abby worked. From here, the conversation spins off in 2 different directions. First, about you. They can't understand why a down-market applicant for credit would ask that question. 2 different worlds. From there, they develop the theory you're a provocateur paid by an outside organization." "And the second direction is about Trulenko himself," Abby said. "There are 2 separate mentions. First, a status check and a threat assessment, which comes back negative, all secure. But an hour later, they start to worry." "Because I got away," Reacher said. "When you hauled me in your door, they knew I was still on the loose." Van Tresca said, "They pulled 4 crews off their regular assignments and told them to report for extra guard duty. They told the existing guards to fall back and form up again as Trulenko's personal detail. They call it Situation B, which we think is a kind of DEFCON level. It's clearly pre-planned, probably rehearsed, maybe even used before.
Okay, Reacher said. A crew is what? Two guys in a car? You would know.
Therefore, eight guys in total, reinforcing how many to start with. How many do they deploy on an everyday zero-threat basis? Not more than four, probably, if they can also seamlessly change into a personal detail afterward. So four fall back, and eight take over the perimeter.
You against 12 guys.
Not if I pick the right spot on the perimeter. I could sneak in a gap. Best case, four guys. Moot point. Unless the phone tells the eight guys exactly where to report for their extra guard duty. A street address would be helpful.
Van Tresca didn't answer. Reacher looked at Abby. She said, "It does say exactly where."
But?
It's an incredibly difficult word. I looked it up all over the place. Originally, it seemed to mean either a hive, or a nest, or a burrow, or all three, or somewhere in between. For something that might have hummed or buzzed or thrashed around. Like a lot of ancient words, it was biologically inexact. Now it seems to be used exclusively as a metaphor, like in the movies, when you see the mad scientist in his lab, full of lit-up machines and crackling energy. That's how the word is used now.
Like a nerve center.
Exactly.
So all the phone says is, report to the nerve center.
Obviously, they know where it is.
The guys I spoke to didn't, Reacher said. I asked them, and I believed them. It's classified information. Which means the crews they just hauled off their regular duties were senior people, in the know.
Makes sense, Van Tresca said. The pick of the litter. Only the best for Situation B.
Told you so, Hogan said. The only route is straight through the top levels.
Barton said, Crazy.
Van Tresca and Abby started work on the Albanian messages, using the same system as before, side by side at the kitchen table. Van Tresca was less familiar with the language, but the texts themselves were more formal and grammatical than their Ukrainian counterparts, so altogether the work went faster. And there was much less to do. All the relevant stuff came during the last few hours. Some of it was familiar. Reacher was once again taken to be a provocateur paid by outside forces. Some of it was new. The white Toyota had been seen driving in. Reacher and Abby had been seen getting out together, after parking way out in the wastelands. A small, slender woman with short, dark hair, and a big, ugly man with short, fair hair. Be on the lookout.
Technically, I think it means plain-featured, Abby said. Or handsome in a rugged kind of way. Not ugly as such.
Reacher said, Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me.
These might, Van Tresca said. He was at the end of the video, the last Albanian text. He said, They're actively looking for you. They're giving an estimate of your current position. They're guessing you're somewhere inside a particular 12-block rectangle.
And are we?
Not far from its exact geographic center.
That's not good, Reacher said.
They seem to have plenty of information.
They have a lot of local knowledge. They have a lot of fingers in a lot of pies, and a lot of eyes behind a lot of windows, and a lot of cars on a lot of streets.
Sounds like you've been studying up on them.
Like I said, I hear things. Everyone has a story. Because everyone comes up against them sooner or later. Whatever you're into, it's the cost of doing business east of Center Street. People get used to it. Ultimately, they see it as reasonable. 10%, like the church used to take back in the olden days. Like taxes. Nothing to be done about it. That part becomes quite civilized. As long as you pay. Which everyone does, by the way. These are scary people.
Sounds like personal experience.
A couple of months ago, I helped a journalist from Washington, D.C. with the local arrangements. I have a private security license. My number is listed in all the national directories. I don't know what her story was going to be about. She wouldn't tell me. Organized crime, I supposed, because that was what she seemed to be interested in. The Albanians and the Ukrainians both. More the Ukrainians, to be honest. That was my impression. But somehow she said the wrong thing east of center, and her first encounter was with the Albanians. They had a face-to-face discussion. A handful of them. And just her, on her own, in the back room of a restaurant. She came out and had me drive her straight to the airport. Not even her hotel first. She didn't want to stop and get her stuff. She was terrified. Deep down scared. She was acting like an automaton. She took the first flight out and never came back. If they could make that happen just by talking to her, you better believe they can make a whole bunch of people keep their eyes peeled for a pair of strangers. Sheer intimidation. That's how they get their information. That's not good either, Reacher said. I don't want to bring bad luck to this household. Neither Barton nor Hogan had a comment, one way or the other. We can't use hotels, Abby said. Maybe we can, Reacher said. Maybe we should. It might be a way of accelerating the process. You're not ready, Hogan said. Barton said, stay the night. You're already here. The neighbors don't have X-ray vision. We have a lunchtime gig tomorrow. If you need to get going, you can ride along in the van. No one will see. Where is the gig? At a lounge west of center. Closer to Trulenko than you are now. Does the lounge have a guy on the door? Always. Probably best to get out around the corner. Or not, if we wanted to accelerate the process. We have to work there, man. It's a good gig for us. Do us a favor and accelerate the process someplace else, if you need to, which I hope you don't, because it's crazy. Deal, Reacher said. We'll ride with you tomorrow. Thank you very much, and for your hospitality tonight. Ventresca left 10 minutes later. Barton locked the doors. Hogan put headphones on and lit a blunt the size of Reacher's thumb. Reacher and Abby went upstairs, to the room with the tipped-up guitar amplifier for a nightstand. 3 blocks away, a brand new text message failed to reach the Albanian phone in the abandoned metal mailbox. A minute later, the same thing happened with the Ukrainian phone. Chapter 29. Dino's right-hand man had the given name Shkumbin, which was a beautiful river deep in the heart of his beautiful homeland. But it was not an easy name to use in English. At first, most people said it Scumbin, some of them tauntingly, but those only once. When they could speak again, after months of dental procedures, they seemed very willing to try very hard with the sound of his name's initial syllable, although that could have been less than perfect reconstructive work. But eventually, Shkumbin got tired of hurting his knuckles, and he took his dead brother's name, partly as a convenience and partly as a tribute. Not his elder dead brother's name, which had been Fatbard, which meant may he be the fortunate one, which was another beautiful name, but again, hard to use in English. Instead, Shkumbin now went by his younger dead brother's name, which was Yetmir, one who will live a good life. Another warm sentiment, and this time easy to say in English, and memorable, quite flashy and futuristic, even if really a traditional blessing, and even if a bit communist-sounding, like a Red Army test pilot in a Soviet comic book, or a hero cosmonaut on a propaganda billboard. Not that Americans seem to care about that stuff anymore. Ancient history. Yetmir got to the conference room in back of the lumberyard office and found the rest of the inner council already assembled. Apart from Dino himself, of course. Dino had not been informed. Not yet. It was their second meeting without him. A big step. One meeting might be explained away. To explain two was exponentially harder. To explain 3 would be impossible. Yetmir said, the missing phone came back online for almost 20 minutes. It sent nothing and received nothing. Then it went dark again, like they're hiding out deep in a basement or something, or an underground cellar, but then they came up to the street, just for a short time, maybe to walk to the corner store and back.
Did we get the location? Someone asked.
We got a pretty good triangulation, but it's a densely populated area. Every corner has a store. But it's right where we thought they would be, close to the center of the shape we marked out.
How close?
I say we forget the 12 blocks we figured before. We can squeeze it down to the middle 4, maybe the middle 6, to be certain.
In a basement?
Or somewhere there's no signal. Maybe they took the battery out and then put it back in.
To do what?
I told you. They didn't make or receive a call.
Okay. A basement.
Or a building with a thick iron frame. Somewhere like that. Keep an open mind. Tell everyone to squeeze in tight. Really flood the area. Look for lights behind drapes. Look for cars and pedestrians. Knock on doors and ask questions if necessary.
At that same moment, Yetmir's opposite number on the other side of Center Street was also in a meeting, also of his inner council, in the room in back of the taxi company, across from the pawn shop, next to the bail bond operation. But in his case, his boss was present. Gregory was right there, as always, at the head of the table, presiding. He had called the meeting himself, right after he heard about one of his downtown guys getting stuck up by Aaron Shevik. He said, "This latest incident feels completely different to me. There was no attempt at deception. He wasn't expecting us to blame the Albanians for it. It was completely blatant, face to face. Apparently, he has been instructed to abandon his earlier tactics in favor of a new phase. I think a mistake. They have revealed more about themselves than they will discover about us."
The phone, his right-hand man said.
"Precisely," Gregory said. "Taking the gun was to be expected. Anyone would. But why the instruction to take the phone?"
"It's a necessary component of their new strategy. They're going to attempt to inflict electronic damage, to weaken us further. They're going to try to get inside our operating system through our phones."
"Who in the whole wide world would have the skills and the experience and the sheer confidence and the deluded arrogance to even hope to succeed with that?"
"Only the Russians," his right-hand man said.
"Precisely," Gregory said again. "Their new tactic has revealed their identity. Now we know. The Russians are moving in on us."
"Not good.
I wonder if they took an Albanian phone, too."
"Probably. The Russians don't like sharing territory. I'm sure they plan to replace us both. This is going to be very tough. There are a lot of them."
There was silence for a long moment. Then Gregory asked, "Can we beat them?"
His right-hand man said, "They won't get inside our operating system."
"Not what I asked."
"Well, whatever we bring to the fight, they bring twice the men, twice the money, and twice the material."
"These are desperate times," Gregory said.
"Truly,
they call for desperate measures."
"Like what?"
"If the Russians are going to bring twice as much as we can, then we need to rebalance the scale. Simple as that. Just temporarily. Just for the time being. Until the present crisis has passed."
"How?"
"We need to form a short-term defensive alliance."
"Who with?"
"Our friends east of center."
"With the Albanians?"
"They're in the same boat."
"Would they do it?"
"Against the Russians. They're going to need it just as much as we do. If we join forces, we might just match them. If we don't, we can't. United we stand, divided we fall."
Silence again.
"It's a big step to take," someone said.
"I agree," Gregory said. "Even weird and crazy, but necessary."
No one spoke after that.
"Okay," Gregory said. I'll go talk to Dino again, first thing in the morning.
Reacher woke up in the gray gloom of night, with the clock in his head showing 4:10. He had heard a sound, a car on the street, outside and below the round window. The bite and grind of brakes, the compression of springs, the stress of tires. A car, slowing to a stop. He waited. Abby slept on beside him, warm and soft and comfortable. The old house creaked and ticked. There was a stripe of light under the door out to the hallway. The bulb over the stairs was still on. Maybe another fixture, too, in a downstairs room. The kitchen or the parlor. Maybe Barton or Hogan was still up. Or both of them, shooting the shit. 4:10 in the morning. Musicians' hours. Out on the street, the car's engine idled quietly. The faint thrash of belts, the whir of a fan, the rustle of pistons slapping up and down, uselessly. Then a faint, muted thump from under the hood, and a sensation of new permanence. The transmission had been shoved forward into park. The engine turned off. Silence again. A door opened. A leather sole clapped down on the sidewalk. A seat spring clicked as weight was lifted off. A second shoe joined the first. Someone stood up straight, with a tiny huff of effort. The door closed. Reacher slid out of bed. He found his pants. He found his shirt. He found his socks. He laced his shoes. He slipped his jacket on, reassuring weight in the pockets. One floor below, there was a loud knock at the street door. A booming wooden sound. 4:10 in the morning. Reacher listened. Heard nothing. In fact, less than nothing. Certainly less than before. Like a hole in the air. It was the negative sound of two guys previously shooting the shit, now dumbstruck and craning around and thinking, what the hell? Barton and Hogan, still up. Musicians' hours. Reacher waited. Deal with it, he thought. Don't make me come downstairs. He heard one of them get to his feet. A sideways shuffle. Looking out the window, probably, through a crack in the drapes. Sideways. Obliquely. He heard a low voice say, Albanian. It was Hogan's voice. Barton's voice whispered back,
How many?
Just one.
What does he want?
I was out sick the day they taught predicting the future.
What should we do?
The knock came again. Boom, boom, boom. Heavy and wooden. Reacher waited. Behind him, Abby stirred and said,
What's happening?
There's an Albanian foot soldier at the door, almost certainly looking for us.
What time is it?
4:08.
What are we going to do?
Barton and Hogan are downstairs. They haven't gone to bed yet. Hopefully they can deal with it.
I should put some clothes on.
Sad, but true. She dressed like he had, fast, pants, shirt, shoes. Then they waited. The knock came for a third time. Bang, boom, bang. The kind of knock you didn't ignore. They heard Hogan offer to get it. They heard Barton accept. They heard Hogan's footsteps across the hallway floor, solid, determined, implacable. The U.S. Marine. The drummer. Reacher wasn't sure which counted for more. They heard the door open. They heard Hogan say, What? Then a new voice, quieter. Because it was outside the structure, not inside, and because of its pitch, which was instantly two things in one, both conversational and mocking. Friendly, but not really. The voice said,
Everything okay in there?
Hogan said, Why wouldn't it be?
I saw the light inside, the voice said. I was worried you had been woken up in the night by a misfortune or a calamity.
It was talking low, but even so it was a big voice, full of physical power, from a big chest and a thick neck, and also full of command and arrogance and entitlement. The guy was accustomed to getting his own way. He had the kind of voice that never said please and never heard no. Deal with it, Reacher thought. Don't make me come downstairs. Hogan said,
We're good in here. Nothing to worry about. No misfortunes. No calamities.
You sure? You'll know we like to help out when we can.
No help required, Hogan said. The light was on because not everyone sleeps at the same time. Not a hard concept to grasp.
Hey, I know all about that, the Albanian guy said. Here I am, working all night long, keeping the neighborhood safe. Actually, you could help me with that, if you like.
Hogan didn't answer.
The guy said, Don't you want to help me with that?
Still no reply.
What goes around comes around, the guy said. It's that kind of thing. You help us now. We'll help you down the road. Could be important. Could be just what you need. Could